The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons,
Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Jerusalem and Rome, is the 14th of a 15-part series from the exile of the 10 tribes to the reign of Herod. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the merit and honor of HaBocher HaBar Mitzvah David Kalman Ben Avram Tzvi Nero Yair David Kalman Sherazin on the occasion of his Bar Mitzvah.
One of the major recurring themes of Jewish history is the struggle between the two twins, Yaakov, Jacob, and Esau. We're given the story that already in the womb, the two children are struggling. And when the mother came for advice to understand what the source of her pain was, she was told, and this is on page 1, this is paragraph A, two nations are in thy womb. Notice these two children really represent two nations, and two manner of people shall be separated from you. And not only will they struggle, but they are entirely different. This struggle lasts throughout their whole lifetimes. And it was a struggle of nations. One of the descendants of Esau, we know, is Amalek, the antithesis of the Jewish people, the archenemy of the Jews. Their presence, we remember constantly. We read it from the Torah. It's one of the major themes of the Purim story, the struggle against Amalek. It seems that at the end of the days, there will again be another struggle with Amalek. But that's only one branch of the children of Esau, Yaakov's twin brother. But there were other branches. According to an ancient tradition, the Romans, or at least some of the Romans, are descendants of Esau. Even though we know by and large that they're known as the Kittim, they're a nation that descended from Yefes. This is not from the Semites. But it seems that there was an infusion of blood from Esau into Rome. In fact, as we read in paragraph B, that this struggle between Esau and Yaakov continued on as the struggle between Rome and Jerusalem. The Roman capital in Palestine was Caesarea. And this teeter-totter, this up-and-down relationship between the two is explained here in this quote from the Gemara Megillah. If someone tells you that both Caesarea and Jerusalem were destroyed, don't believe it. As one represents Caesarea, the Roman dominance, one Jerusalem, or the Jewish spiritual dominance. If someone tells you that both of them are thriving, don't believe it. But if you are told Jerusalem is built up while Caesarea is in ruins, or the reverse, that Caesarea is built up while Yerushalayim is in ruins, you may believe it. It's believable. And Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchak quotes the source, is this pasuk, that the verse that we quoted before, and that one people shall be stronger than the other people, this constant struggle between them. It's interesting, find in paragraph C, that not only is there the allusion of the struggle of the two nations but also the blessing of the two nations. The word for nations is goyim. And the Gemara says that one could alternately read this as geyim, aristocrats. And this is an allusion to the fact that there was a time in history that both the most leading Jewish figure, the head of the Sanhedrin, the Nasi, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the prince, and Antoninus, which according to historians is the very famous Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius, were close friends. And both enjoyed a measure of tremendous wealth. Rashi in Chumash, and it turns to page 2. Quoting the Medrash. The Duke, says Aluf Magdiel, the Duke of Magdiel, referring to the different leaders amongst Edom, Esav, was the governor of a land of peoples that eventually became the Romans. Magdiel, according to Rashi, refers to Rome. So we find one branch of Esav being Amalek, the arch enemy of the Jews, and another branch becoming Rome. It's interesting in the literatures in the Middle Ages, Barbanel and others go on to explain the idea of the twins, of the struggle of who is the rightful firstborn, continued on with the Roman Catholic Church. As the Catholic Church denied that Yisroel, the Jews, were the chosen of Hashem, they had been superseded by Rome. And this struggle of Rome and Yerushalayim, in essence, continues to this day. What could point to the fact that even now, over 40 years founding the State of Israel, 45 years, the Vatican has not recognized the State of Israel. It's an impossibility, in their view. Either it's Rome or Yerushalayim. The Jews really, in their view, have no place. And it's a remarkable idea of twins. They claim, are the true Israel. The Ramban, in his disputations with the Roman Catholic Church, this was in the court of the King of Barcelona, James of Barcelona, in the year 1263, explained the role of Mashiach. And in the Ramban's view, Mashiach would eventually go to Rome because so many Jews were under Christian influence then, basically. And he said, let my people go, just as Moses had done so many years before. How did Esav get to Rome? And how did the descendants find their way to Rome? The Vilna Gaon, in his commentary on the Megillah, offers the explanation that in the years of the Assyrian conquest, when the Assyrians displaced peoples, and there were major changes, political changes, ethnic changes, there were those of Edom who traveled across Europe and eventually made their way to Italy and to Rome. But there's another tradition which we find on page 2 in paragraph F. Sappho, the son of Aliphaz, the son of Esav, this is a grandson of Esav, contested Yosef's right to bury Yaakov. This is the story when Yaakov died. His body was transported
to Eretz Yisrael for the Moras HaMachpelah. This is the burial place of his forefathers. And Esav came and his family and said that since they're the first, Esav is the firstborn, he has the right to be buried and not Yaakov. And there was a major battle. Part of the story is recorded in the Gemara in Sota and Yud Gimel. But another part of the story is recorded in the Ramban. He finally went to battle with the forces of Yosef, this Tzifo. Yosef was victorious and captured Tzifo and his best troops. He took them back with him to Egypt. Tzifo languished in prison till the death of Yosef when he escaped and made his way to the land of Campania, which is north of Rome, and ruled over the Kittim in Rome, as the Roman people are the Kittim. Eventually he ruled over all of Italy and was the first king of Rome. He was the one who built the first and greatest palace ever constructed in Rome. According to this tradition, it seems he actually lived in Rome. There's another tradition, not necessarily totally contradicting this. This is really the city of Rome was built much later. Perhaps it's in the general area, and those people who eventually became the Romans are descendants of these people. And this is the last paragraph here on page 2, paragraph G, which highlights the place of Rome in our history. Rabbi Yehuda said that Shmuel said the following: when King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, married the daughter of Paro, the angel Gavriel planted a reed in the sea. Now, this was considered a major sin on Solomon's part. She was the one who actually introduced the form of idolatry into Israel, which had been forgotten for many years. And it seemed to have been the fact that we slided back the Jews from the level that we had reached. And silt settled around the stick and formed dry land. On this land, the great city of Rome was built. Now, the first sins of the Jews, the city began taking shape. In a braisa we learned on the day that Yerovam, was after the death of Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, in his son's reign, there was a split. The northern kingdom split off from the southern kingdom. Rehoboam, the son of Shlomo, still maintained power over the southern kingdom, but there was a revolt, and the northern 10 tribes went along with Yerovam. But Yerovam, in order to cement his power, introduced a form of idolatry, reintroduced the worship of the golden calf. So the Brisim, on the day that Yerovam introduced the worship of the two golden calves, one in Basel and one in Don, a hut was built on the area of Italy of Greece, which is the name which is given for Rome. That area was right below it, where Naples was settled by Greeks. There was tremendous Greek influence in the area, and the area was called Talia Shel Yovan. It's important to put this in perspective with the blessing that Yitzchok, that Isaac, gave to his son Yaakov. Because although the blessing was that Yaakov would have dominance over Esav, but if Yaakov should fall in a spiritual level, then Esav will take the dominant role. And this is really what's meant by when the Jews slipped, when Solomon married the daughter of Paro and idolatry was introduced, when Yerovam created the cult of the two golden calves, the Jews were slipping. Rome was beginning its ascendancy. The era that we're speaking about tonight is the era when Rome did gain its ascendancy. And as the Ramban explains in his commentary on Chumash, the events that are described in the 28th chapter of Devarim, of Deuteronomy, refer to the events that transpired during the latter period of the Second Temple. On page 3, in paragraph H, I've quoted three verses which refer to three events in the Second Temple period. The first one, "The Lord shall bring thee and thy king, which thou shalt set over thee, unto a nation which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, and there shalt thou serve other gods, wood and stone." In other words, it's referring to a king that will be taken away by force. This is widely interpreted to refer to the king that we studied last time, Aristobulus. Aristobulus, who was an heir to the Maccabee dynasty, just to recap a little bit, the founder of the dynasty was Mattathias. He had five sons. The last surviving son was Shimon. And in Shimon's time, the Maccabees finally knew peace. And he was crowned as the Kohen Gadol, as the high priest. His son, in turn, was Yochanan Hyrcanus, whose son, in turn, was Yanai. Yanai had two sons, Hyrcanus, the oldest son, who originally became the Kohen Gadol, and Aristobulus, the younger son. Upon the death of Yanai, Hyrcanus, this is after a hiatus of some 9 years, when the mother, Sholomtzion Salome, was the reigning queen. After her death, Hyrcanus took the reins of leadership, the role of the Kohen Gadol, which he had before, but now not just as a symbolic office, but really as a governmental office. Aristobulus waged war against him, unseated him, and for some 3 years acted as the king. Hyrcanus, with the aid of Antipater, this is his Idumean advisor, laid siege to Aristobulus. He and an army of Arabs of Nabataeans laid siege to Aristobulus. Eventually the Romans were called in. Pompey, being the leader of the Romans in the area, he had just conquered Syria. He eventually displaced Aristobulus, took him back in chains to Rome, and Hyrcanus was reinstated as the leader. This first verse is widely understood to refer to Aristobulus, that he was taken by the Romans, a foreign nation, a nation that your forefathers didn't know. The next verse is really the theme of this week's lecture. "Is the stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low." This is in chapter 28. This one is verse 43. This is widely understood to refer to Herod. This Antipater was an Idumean. The Idumeans were descendants of Esav. And again we find the role of Esav, the brother of Yaakov. Even though Antipater officially was just an advisor, at least originally, to Hyrcanus, eventually he was named to be the governor of Palestine by the Romans. This is what we're going to be studying tonight. And eventually his son Herod became the king officially of Palestine. Their status, according to Chazal, according to the Talmud, was that of a slave. They were quasi-Jews. And they ruled, eventually Herod ruled the Jews without mercy. And as we're going to see, wanted really to become the king of all nations, of all the people in that area. The Jews were just one of many ethnic groups. Even though we think of the Second Temple period as the Jews living in Palestine, and this is the Jewish area, there are many ethnic groups. There are Syrian Greeks. There are many different groups that live there. Herod didn't like the Jews. The Jews didn't respect him. They deemed him to be merely a slave. He taxed them to death in order to win the favor of all the other nations that were in Palestine, that general area. And this is a theme that we're going to continue on tonight. But it is understood, again, this last sentence, the stranger refers to Herod. And this last sentence, the Lord shall bring a nation against thee from afar, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flieth, a nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand, is understood to be the Romans. Latin was not a tongue, it was not a Semitic tongue, it was not a tongue that they understood. And eventually it's these people that brought down the downfall of the Jews and forced them into exile and destroyed the temple. We continue our story now, this is on page 3, this is the second section, entitled Romans Consolidate Their Power. After Aristobulus is taken in chains, Aristobulus had two sons. We're going to hear about them soon. One was Alexander, and one was Antigonus. Alexander, as we have in paragraph A, page 3, wanted to regain power. It was taken away from him rightfully. It was Antigonus, his father was the king. The Romans had really taken over Palestine, annexed Palestine, and made it part of the Roman Empire. And Alexander went to fight against the Romans. The Romans brought in a commander, Gabinus. And as you read, this is in paragraph A, eventually defeated Alexander. He was defeated in battle. And from paragraph B, eventually gave up all the fortresses that he had conquered. Alexander's mother, that won favor in the eyes of the Romans, asked for mercy on his behalf. He was not killed. But now Gabinus took firm control of Eretz Yisrael. And he instituted, which is we're going to touch upon now and we're going to continue in the next lecture, something that radically changed the face of Torah Jewry. This is in the bold print, paragraph B. And when he ordained five councils, he distributed the same nation into the same number of parts. In other words, instead of having a central Sanhedrin, a central court of law, that not only had judicial powers, but legislative powers, and as we've explained in previous lectures, that they had the position of Nasi had a quasi-governmental power. They took care of the social needs. They took care of the Yisoimim. They represented Torah Jewry to the foreign nations. And he wanted Gabinus to somehow destroy the power of the Sanhedrin. And therefore, he disallowed that there exist a central body. But there be five equal bodies. So these councils govern the people. The first was at Jerusalem, the second at Gadara, the third of Amathus, this is Chomos, the fourth of Jericho, Yericho, the fifth, and Sepphoris and Tsippori. As we're going to see, this had a terrible effect on Jewry. Because whenever there was a question in Torah law, if the lower courts did not know, did not have a tradition, about what the correct approach to deal with the problem was, they would go up to the higher court. And finally would go up to the highest court. That highest court was the final word. Well, their final decision, based on a majority vote, decided what the halacha was. But now the Sanhedrin was not allowed to act in that capacity. There were five equal bodies. The best and the brightest were not located in one central area, but they were really divided up across the country. So it was impossible from that time to get a real consensus. In fact, even though we often borrow the term of majority rule, the Rajba, or Shlomo ben Aderes, one of the great medieval commentators, he was a Rav in Barcelona, 13th century, explains that the law of majority, that one is bound by their decision, is only in a situation of a court where all the members have come together, they've discussed the issue face to face, they come to a final vote, and that vote is binding upon all. But if you have certain people who live in one city, and others in another city, and another group in another city, even though if we count heads, the majority will hold one view, we are never certain that perhaps if the minority would have articulated their views to the present majority, perhaps they would have influenced the majority to their side. But they never met face to face. They didn't have that, the process of discussion or a final vote. So therefore, we don't have the idea of the majority, at least the Torah's idea of majority does not apply. There's another rule, which when in doubt, yochad v'rabim halacha karabim. If I don't know, so in all probability I still go with the majority. But it doesn't carry with it that force of Torah law. It's rather, it carries the same force. If you don't know, you generally gravitate to someone who is superior in knowledge or age or experience. But it doesn't have the teeth that the Torah law says that one must go after the majority. So therefore, after these five councils were created, and we no longer had all the great minds, the greatest minds in a single body, we developed the idea of questions of law and different opinions that never came to a resolution. And this really laid the groundwork, as we're going to see next week, for the arguments between the house of Shammai and the house of Hillel. In previous generations, the whole idea of two houses dealing with different issues and coming to different opinions without a resolution was unfeasible, because there was always a central Sanhedrin. But now, because of Gabinus' ruling that they must be divided, we began now a new era where we didn't have all of the Chachmei Yisrael, the great scholars, in a central unit, in a central body that was able to decide together on issues that affected them all. The story, as Josephus, we continue on, is really, we're going just to touch upon this, is one war after another. You have to hold on to your program here. See who's who. After Alexander, the son of Aristobulus, was defeated, Aristobulus himself, this is the former king, managed to run away from Rome. He went and rebuilt Alexandrium, which was a fortress. He got himself an army. And again, Gabinus tried to make order. And he eventually defeated Aristobulus. And again, Aristobulus was sent back to Rome. And from there, he never left. After the abortive revolt of Aristobulus, again, Alexander tried. And again, Gabinus put down that revolt as well. Now, just to give you a sense of the years here, as we're going to get, I'd like you to turn to the back page. Here, there's a timeline. Just to give you an idea of when this is all happening and who are the players. The first date, 76, for the Common Era, represents the year that Yanai died and Alexandra Salome, this is his wife, began her reign. It was a reign of 9 years. After her death, Aristobulus began. His first Hyrcanus became the king. And then Aristobulus waged a war against him, took over the power. After Hyrcanus besieged Jerusalem, and the Romans came in to be the broker here of the conflict, Pompey eventually conquered Jerusalem. And Hyrcanus, this is Hyrcanus II because of his grandfather was Yochanan Hyrcanus, began his reign. Okay. The one who, now we get back to the, just if you see the, there's a sense here. The next, we said the major player here. Really, if you remember your Roman history, was a member of the first triumvirate. Julius Caesar, Pompey, this is who had conquered Jerusalem, and Crassus were the first triumvirate. They jointly ruled the Roman Empire. Now, Crassus left Rome with an army to meet the challenge of the Parthians. The Parthians were those people who were ruling Persia. The ancient Parthia is really the north of, north Iran, Afghanistan. They were not the original Persians who come from southern Iran. But it's still called Poras, it was still part of the Persian Empire. But technically these are the Parthians. He went to wage war with the Parthians. On his way, stopped Jerusalem and really gutted the temple and took all the gold that belonged to the temple. There was the gold that belonged to the temple not only represented with the accumulative wealth and donations of Jews from throughout the world, but it represented monies that belonged to orphans, widows. There's all this money and all this wealth was taken by Crassus. But he fared pretty well in Jerusalem. He didn't fare too well against the Parthians, and he was defeated, and he died in the Parthian campaign. Cassius, who was a general under Crassus, eventually had much power. Basically, he was the one who led the troops away after the defeat. He eventually had much power in Rome. He was the one who was responsible for the death of Julius Caesar. Remember Julius Caesar, the Cassius and Brutus. This is while Caesar was still alive. But he was on the outs, and we find on page 5 in paragraph F. But Cassius, as he fled from Rome to Syria, took possession of it. And was an impediment to the Parthians. And he led the army now against the Roman army, against the Parthians, to prevent them from taking over Syria. But as you'll see, I just want to read this to you, just understand the sense of what Jews were going through. You have to realize this is revolt after revolt. It was plundered by the Romans. The Jews rose up, and they were squelched time and time again. You can imagine the suffering, just in human terms, that the Jews were going through. This also gives you just a sense of what was happening. As he came back to Tyre, he went up to Judea also and fell upon Tarichae. Tarichae is an area near it's east of the Sea of Galilee. And presently took it and carried about 30,000 Jews captives. And then slew Pithalaus, who succeeded Aristobulus in his seditious practices. He came here basically as part to squelch again another revolt. And this by the persuasion of Antipater. He squelched this through Antipater, who was really the power behind the throne. Antipater, as you remember, was the Idumean advisor to Hyrcanus. This paragraph goes on to explain Antipater's family, Phasael and Herod, Joseph and Pheroras. And Josephus goes in great detail about their stories. He goes on, Josephus, this is all taken from Antiquities of Josephus, in paragraph G. About what was the fate of the survivors of Aristobulus when Caesar crossed the Rubicon. He was the governor of Gaul, of France, and in his power struggle with Pompey fled. And sometime afterwards, Caesar, when he had taken Rome, and after Pompey and the Senate were fled beyond the Ionian Sea, he freed Aristobulus from his bonds and resolved to send him into Syria and deliver two legions to him, that he might see matters right as being a potent man in that country. In other words, Caesar viewed at this point Hyrcanus and Antipater as allies of Pompey. And to cement his influence, he wanted his man in that position. So he released Aristobulus, sent with him two legions. But Aristobulus had no enjoyment of what he had hoped for from the power that was given him by Caesar. For those of Pompey's power party prevented it and destroyed him by poison. And those of Caesar's party buried him. His dead body also lay for a good while embalmed in honey until Antony afterwards sent him to Judea and caused him to be buried in a Roman sepulcher. That was the fate of Aristobulus. He was sent in bonds. Even after his first rebellion, he was sent again, and eventually he was poisoned, buried he was sent to rest in a foreign land. Until afterwards he was disinterred and reburied in Judea. But Scipio, which was another Roman general, upon Pompey sending him to slay Alexander, the son of Aristobulus, because there was this fear that he would begin a new revolt, and then, again, being an ally of Caesar's, would be a power to be reckoned with in the area where Pompey's allies were. So he sent him to slay Alexander because the young man was accused of what offenses he'd been guilty of at first against the Romans, cut off his head, and thus did he die at Antioch. And as we're going to see, it's not a very pleasant story, but one after one of the family of the Hashmonaim were eventually put to death. Antipater was a very shrewd man. And after Pompey was killed in battle, firmed his ties with Caesar. And in fact, Josephus goes on in great detail to explain that he fought for Caesar on behalf to gain Egypt. As you could look at it yourself. But in the on page 6, this is before paragraph B, or the paragraph before B. However, when Caesar, after some time, had finished that war and was sailed away for Syria, he honored Antipater greatly, because actually he led the army. He was a very capable military leader, and confirmed Hyrcanus in the high priesthood, and bestowed on Antipater the privilege of a citizen of Rome, and the freedom from taxes everywhere. This was the first step in Antipater's rise to power. On paragraph B, when Antigonus, the last surviving son of Aristobulus, this is on page 6, tried to influence Caesar, he, quote, lamented his father's fate, and complained that it was Antipater's means that Aristobulus was taken off by poison, which is what gives a new slant over here. Because it wasn't just Pompey, but it was really instigated by Antipater himself. And his brother was beheaded by Scipio, and desired that he would take pity of him who had been ejected out of that principality which was due him. He also accused Hyrcanus Antipater as governing the nation by violence, and offering injuries to him personally. Antipater was present, made his defense as to the accusations that were laid against him. When Antipater had made this speech, Caesar appointed Hyrcanus to be high priest again, and gave Antipater what principality he himself should choose. In other words, he gave him renewed power. In other words, instead, this had a boomerang effect. In other words, instead of securing his power, Antigonus really lost much more, and Antipater was given, seeing what kind of a person Antipater was, evidently Caesar had a renewed respect for him. Leaving the determination to himself, he chose Judea, so Caesar made him procurator, that's the governor of Judea. He was really became the highest Roman official of Judea. He was already made a Roman citizen. Now he became a Roman governor. And it's in this position that Antipater had, and Hyrcanus again became pushed aside once more to a very weak, having virtually no real power, and was really just a figurehead, that Antipater saw the opportunity to promote his children, Antipater's children, to a position of power. He divided up the whole of Eretz Yisrael. Phasaelus, his oldest son, he made governor of Yerushalayim, but Galilee he gave to Herod. Even though Josephus, as you see here, quotes a figure who's 15 years of age, the commentators on Josephus says the must be a scribal era, and he was at least 25 years at the time. But here we find now his next move to power. Herod now became the governor of Galilee. And in this position of governor, Josephus tells us a story which had tremendous import, not only for, as we see, the history of Judea as a whole, of Hyrcanus, of Herod, but also we see the position of Torah. There are a group of bandits who evidently were prowling on the residents of Syria. The name of the head of the bandits was Chizkiah. Herod came and slew him and a great number of his men. And evidently it was understood that he overstepped his bond, He should have merely, evidently, banditry does not warrant a death penalty. He was not charged. He didn't have that power. And the Sanhedrin wanted to try Herod. And in fact, they brought Herod. They forced Hyrcanus to bring Herod in front of the Sanhedrin. But Herod came not alone, but a whole army. And all the members of the Sanhedrin were frightened of Herod and his show of display of strength. The Sanhedrin, as a judicial body, there were five Sanhedrins, but he was put in front of the Sanhedrin that was in Yerushalayim. He was probably the first amongst equals. And evidently they felt that this was the place of the resident place of where Antipater lived and Hyrcanus lived, and this is the place he should be tried. And they were all frightened of him, except for one who has a great place in Jewish history by the name of Shammai. We all know that the Beis Shammai, the house of Shammai, he was a colleague of Hillel. And he stood up to Herod. And here on page 7, let's read some of this in the bold print. When affairs stood thus, one whose name was Simeas, that's Shammai, a righteous man he was, for that reason above all fear, notice he was beyond all fear, who rose up and said, O you that are assessors with me, with the colleagues, and O thou art our king, I neither have myself known such a case, nor do I suppose that any of you can name its parallel, the one who is called to take his trial by us ever stood in such a manner before us. But every one whosoever he be, that comes to be tried by this Sanhedrin, presents himself in a submissive manner. And the like one that is in fear of himself, and endeavors to move us to compassion with his hair disheveled in black mourning garment. This admirable man Herod, who was accused of murder and called to answer so heavy an accusation, stands here clothed in purple. Purple was the royal garb. And with the hair of his head finely trimmed. What's the name of our president's... They didn't have a tarmac in those days. And with his armed men above him, about him, that if we shall condemn him by our law, he may slay us, and by overbearing justice may himself escape death. Yet do not I make this complaint against Herod. However, take you notice that God is great, that this very man whom you are going to absolve and dismiss for the sake of Hyrcanus will one day punish both you and your king himself also. This was Shammai's speech. And Josephus goes on to comment, nor did Shammai mistake any part of his prediction. For when Herod received the kingdom, he slew all the members of the Sanhedrin. And Hyrcanus himself also. Eventually he killed Hyrcanus, excepting Shammai. For he had a great honor for him on account of his righteousness, and because when the city, and this is another incident, when the city was afterwards besieged by Herod and Sosius, Sosius was the Roman general, he persuaded the people to admit Herod into it and told them that for their sins they would not be able to escape his hands. You know, it wouldn't make a difference, you know, Sebashelt says that you might as well open up, it's not going to help anyway. But Herod had tremendous respect for Shammai. And as a result, even though he killed many, Shammai and his yeshiva he let stand. Hyrcanus saw to it, after this event, that Herod left Yerushalayim, did not return. But in fact, Herod gathered an army and marched on Yerushalayim as a sign of strength and also to teach Hyrcanus a lesson that he even attempted to bring in front of the Sanhedrin, even though Hyrcanus helped them escape. But he wanted to show him who's boss. Herod had to be quieted down not to do anything more than just bring an army to the gates of Yerushalayim. But he had made his point. Eventually, an ally of Antipater's, was a general under him, Malichus, poisoned Antipater to death. This is on page 8, paragraph F. And eventually, says Herod himself, took revenge and killed this Malichus. Now that Antipater was out of the way, Antigonus, the son of Aristobulus, realize Aristobulus was the brother of this Hyrcanus, now who is the high priest. Aristobulus had been killed. Aristobulus' son Alexander had been killed, but he had a surviving son, Antigonus. Antigonus raised an army, but he was defeated by Herod. In the after the death of Julius Caesar, and this happened evidently right before, around his death, after the death of Caesar by Cassius and Brutus, there was a civil war, and there was a second triumvirate of Octavian, the nephew of Caesar's, Mark Antony, and Lepidus. They eventually defeated the forces of Cassius and Brutus, the killers of Caesar, at Philippi. When Antony came into power, again, he cemented his relations with Herod. And after the defeat, as we said, of Antigonus, his position became stronger. But Antigonus did not give up. And together with the Parthians, he made a pact. And they went and attacked Jerusalem, attacked Judea. Eventually, they were able to take Hyrcanus and Herod's oldest brother. Hyrcanus himself had to flee for his life. And again, the kingdom went back into the family of Aristobulus, and was Antigonus, his son. But to give you a sense of what kind of a person this Antigonus was, we turn to page 11, the beginning of the page. And thus was Antigonus brought back into Judea by the king of the Parthians, and received Hyrcanus and Phasaelus, this is the oldest brother of Herod, for his prisoners. He had offered originally, you know, what about Antigonus, that he would give them a sum of money plus 500 women he would give the Parthians. But he was greatly cast down because the women that he wanted to give as concubines or whatever to them had escaped, whom he intended to give, given the enemy as having promised they should have them with the money for their reward. But being afraid that Hyrcanus, who was under guard of the Parthians, might have his kingdom restored to him by the multitude, he cut off his ears, and therefore took care that the high priest would never come to him any more, because he was maimed, while the law required that his dignity should belong to none but such as had their, all their members, their Evorim and Tyre. He eventually also put this Phasaelus to death. This is a point that we've discussed before when we discussed the story of Yanai, the father of Aristobulus, of Hyrcanus. Yanai, Aristobulus, Hyrcanus, Antigonus, Alexander were Sadducan, were Sadducees. As we explained in the previous lectures, the Sadducees had really no religious compunction. They didn't believe in life after death. They didn't believe that God really cares about the affairs of humanity. It seems that really any form of religious espousal that they had was merely a national sentiment, similar to the fact that Americans have a turkey at Thanksgiving or fireworks on the 4th of July. It's not necessarily anything very religious, but it's really just part of being part of the nation. So too, their practice of Judaism was really a national one, but not truly a religious one. And again, these when we read the stories of these people and their attempts to gain power and all the misery that they inflicted on others, we see people that did not live their lives according to the Torah. Having Antigonus would really be the choice of the better of two evils, him over Herod, rather than this would be the real choice of the Jews. Herod eventually made his way to Rome, pleaded his cause, that now the country had been taken over by Antigonus and the Parthians, to Mark Antony. And if you notice in the bold face, because Herod offered him money to make him king, he gave him the position of king. There's a theme that Josephus repeats time and again, and it's a theme that we find in Chazal, in the works of the Talmud or the Medrash, about the power that Rome always wanted bribery. Anything that was done with them was with bribes. It seems the Medrash finds the source of this way of dealing with them is the original story of Yaakov, that he sends all the presents to his brother Esav. The idea of sending presents set the tone for what became the common way of dealing with the Romans. He who gave the most money won. And in fact, when we read last time the story of Pompey and Aristobulus, he originally, in the shifting sands of the political alliances, he originally opted to be the ally of Aristobulus because Aristobulus paid him more. The one who paid more was the dear and close friend. And again, says Herod, besides pleading his cause, offered him money, as he had formerly given to him to make him tetrarch. Now, there's a minor position that he had, evidently was due to the money he gave. Now the position of king again was because of all the money that he had given. Herod now, as king of the Jews, came back with a Roman army. And we read on page 12 in paragraph E, Herod had now a strong army as he marched on. Antigonus laid snares and ambushes in the passes and places most proper for them, but in truth he thereby did little or nor damage to the enemy. But despite the fact that he came with an army, it took him 3 years, it took Herod 3 years to displace Antigonus. And finally, read on page 12 in paragraph F, Antigonus, without regard to either his past or present circumstances, came down from the citadel. This is after the defeat. And it's described in great detail in paragraph A. And fell down at the feet of Sosius, who was the Roman general, who took no pity of him in the change of his fortune, but put him into bonds and kept him close custody. This destruction befell the city of Jerusalem when Marcus Agrippa and Caninius Gallus were consuls of Rome on the 185th Olympiad, on the third month, on the solemnity of the fast, as if it were a periodical revolution of calamities that had returned since that which befell the Jews under Pompey. For the Jews were taken by him on the same day. This was after 27 years' time. There was a, it's not clear from the commentaries which fast, but there's a tradition that on the 23rd day of Sivan is a fast day. In fact, it's brought in the Shulchan Aruch. It's on it's in Simon Tov Kuf Pei in 580. There are days that we still fast, or it's preferred to still fast. One of them is the 23rd day of the Hebrew month of Sivan. And the reason being, as we began, as the golden calves were introduced in Israel, there's the cult of the golden calf by Yerovam in the northern kingdom, were introduced on that day. If you notice before, the relationship between the golden calves and Rome, you know, on page 2, on the bottom, in the last paragraph on the bottom, in Ebraica we learned that on the day that Yerovam introduced the worship of the two golden calves, one in Basel and one in Don, a hut was built on the area of Italy. That's when it started. It was that day that Pompey conquered Jerusalem, and it was on that same day that finally Herod conquered Jerusalem again with the help of the Romans. And then we see this as history repeats itself, and really as a sign that the evils, the ills that befell the Jews was not just mere happenstance, but it was a recreation on a different form of the same sins that the golden calves were built, again, evidently because of the shortcomings of the Jews. Rome gained the upper hand. On that day, Pompey conquered Jerusalem, and Sosius with Herod conquered Jerusalem. I mean, it's an amazing coincidence. Antigonus was carried in bonds to Antony in Rome. But Herod, this is on the bottom of page 12, was afraid lest Antigonus should be kept in prison by Antony. He would be carried to Rome by him. Antony was not in Rome at the time. He may get his cause to be heard by the Senate, and might demonstrate, as he himself was of the royal blood, and as he may put a good case, Antigonus, that Antigonus is deserving of the position of king, and not Herod, who was after all just an Idumean slave. And Herod, but a private man, on page 13, and therefore belonged to his sons, whoever to have the kingdom, on account of the family they were in case, they were of. In case he had himself, he was afraid that Herod might not have bought enough money and himself offended the Romans by what he had done. So out of Herod's fear of this, he gave Antony a large amount of money and had Antigonus slain. Again, everything went with money. And he ends off Josephus, and thus did the government of the Hashmonaim cease. This is the Maccabees, 126 years after it was first set up. The Talmud, and Avodah Zorah, and Tesalmud Aleph, and 9a, brings that the years of the Maccabee reign were 103. However, Josephus is counting from the time of the beginning of the revolt. This family was a splendid and as illustrious one. After all of Antigonus' heirs were killed now. In other words, Aristobulus was killed, Alexander had been killed, now this final Antigonus had been killed. Soon, we're going to see that Herod killed Hyrcanus. There was no one left of the whole house of Hashmonaim. And he bemoaned this, was splendid and illustrious, both on account of the nobility of their stock, the dignity of the high priesthood, also for the glorious actions their ancestors had performed for our nation, referring to the Maccabees. But these men lost the government by their dissensions one with another, and it came to Herod, the son of Antipater, who was of no more than a vulgar family, of no eminent extraction, but one that was subject to other kings, because really he was just a vassal king of the Romans. And this is what history tells us was the end of the Hashmonaim family. Yes, but eventually there was nothing left of the house of Hashmonaim. In fact, the Gemara says that anyone who claims descent of the house of Hashmonaim is merely only a pretender, is really only a slave. Nothing was left. And this descendant of Esau, this Edomian, Herod, sealed the fate of the independence of Jewry. And in fact, as we're going to see the next quote, there's probably no worse ruler for Jewry in the entire history of our people. Because he hated Jews. And what I'm going to quote from you is now after Herod had died. And if you just take a look at the timeline, you get a sense of the period, and maybe we should go through this before we read the last paragraph. At 63, in the year 60, Pompey conquered Jerusalem. We go through the defeat of Crassus, the Roman Civil War, the death of Pompey, the death of Caesar, the Battle of Philippi, when Cassius and Brutus were killed. Then the Parthian invasion, Antigonus conquers Jerusalem, and Herod begins his reign. That was in 37. The year 40, actually, he was given the title of king, but it was on paper only. In 37, he really began his reign. 31 B.C. is the Battle of Actium, which is Mark Antony and Cleopatra against Octavian. This is who eventually became Augustus Caesar. In the year 4 before the Common Era, Herod died. Archelaus became, his son became the king. And he was such a terrible king. There was a whole delegation. It was done time and time again. But there was a whole delegation beseeching the Romans that Herod's posterity should not rule over the Jews. Just they wanted the Romans directly. They felt the Romans directly would be much more fair, if you can imagine it, would deal with them in a much more even-handed manner than Herod's children. Now, just to read G. This is widely quoted by historians. Give you a sense of the period. What was it like being ruled by Herod? Now, upon the liberty that was given the Jewish ambassadors to speak, as they spoke to the Roman government, they who hoped to obtain a dissolution of kingly government betook themselves to accuse Herod of his iniquities, and they declared that he was indeed in name a king, but he had taken to himself the uncontrollable authority which tyrants exercise over their subjects, made use of that authority for the destruction of the Jews, and did not abstain from making many innovations among them besides, according to his own inclinations. And that whereas there were a great many who perished by that destruction he brought upon them, so many indeed as no other history relates, as many, Time doesn't allow to quote all the sources in Josephus, but it seems that he had a whole spy network, more similar to the KGB of recent history. Anyone who uttered anything would be taken and killed. It was a reign of terror. They that survived were far more miserable than those that suffered death under him, not only by the anxiety that they were in from his looks and disposition towards them, because he was always afraid they would be the next one, but from the danger their estates were in of being taken away by him. That he did never leave off adorning these cities that lay in their neighborhood, but were inhabited by foreigners. In other words, the non-Jewish cities he built up, and they were built by Jewish taxes. But so that the cities belonging to his own government were ruined and utterly destroyed, that whereas when he took the kingdom, it was in an extraordinary flourishing condition, he had filled that nation with the utmost degree of poverty, and when upon unjust pretenses he had slain any of the nobility, he took away their estates, and when he permitted any of them to live, he condemned them to the forfeiture of what they possessed. And besides the annual impositions, this is the taxes which he laid upon every one of them, they were to make liberal presents to himself, to his domestics and friends, and to such of his slaves that were vouchsafed the favor of being his tax gatherers. No, they had to schmear, they had to bribe this one and that one, because there was no way of obtaining a freedom from unjust violence without giving either gold or silver for it. That they would say nothing of the corruption of the chastity of their virgins and the reproach laid upon their wives for the infidelity. And those things acted after an insolent and human manner, because it was not a smaller pleasure to the sufferers to have such things concealed than it would have been not to have suffered them. In other words, they had to, at least it was done, the fact that he had taken and what it seduced or raped these women, the fact is he kept it hush-hush was just only a small nechama, was a small consolation to the fact that it was done. That Herod had put such abuses upon them as a wild beast would not have put on them if he had the power given him to rule over us. That although their nation had passed through many subversions and alterations of government, their history gave no account of any calamity they had ever been under that could be compared with this which Herod had brought upon their nation. This is verbatim an account of the speech that it seems the members of the Sanhedrin, I mean the leaders of Jewry, made to the Romans to plead that they should change the government. Because at least if the Romans had the government, there would be equality for all citizens. Whereas now Herod had made them inferior. And one could really understand, if we turn to page 3, the fulfillment of the prophecy, in the second sentence, the stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. Because the Jews during the reign of Herod were really second-class citizens. And the Greeks and the other nations that inhabited were raised to a very high position. Next lecture we'll continue on with a happier note. And this is the life of Hillel. Now, are there any questions?
This book of the Antiquities that you're using, yeah. Is there any Jewish commentary?
It's in English. It's available. This is written by... Now, Josephus wrote this in Latin. There is a Hebrew counterpart to Josephus, which is called Josephon. However, it seems that Josephon is really not an original work by Josephus, but a later work from the 9th century of the Common Era, which is a compilation of Josephus and Midrashic, you know, from other from other sources, and was really the work which was available to Jews during the Middle Ages, because they didn't have access to the original in Latin. It was only later on in the 19th century that this work, the Antiquities, became available really to Jewry as a whole. It was translated into Hebrew.
But who are the copies?
The church.
The church. Yeah. Got it out of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I mean, it was part of it was Latin scholarship. I mean, it wasn't, you know.
Without this antiquity, you're saying that this history
of the Jews
would have been relatively unknown.
That's right. Well, we have it. Some of it is preserved in Yosefon. Yeah, but not in its entirety, not the way we're presenting it now. That's right.
That's right.
Oh, that's another whatever he was. He wasn't from the Lamed Vav Tzaddikim. He wasn't from. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. All the buildings from there are what is now still Israel. They have.
Right, but they are pagan buildings. They were built by pagans. There were pagan temples. Places of nobility or government, right? They have survived. There was one positive work that was built by Herod, and that was the rebuilding of the temple. The time really doesn't allow to go into the details of that, but in the Dogarach we don't have that. One thing which is interesting, if you visit Yerushalayim, you see the place of the temple, you see the Kosel Maravi. As Josephus himself describes, the stones are made in a peculiar way, that they are indented on the sides, and this gives a sense of raised in the middle. That really is his stamp of all the things which he had built during the period, right, the Herodian stone. But there's very little left from the temple, not which we have in Caesarea and other places are really pagan edifices. Right. Now, it's an interesting thing. Why did Herod rebuild the temple? Why did he beautify it? The Talmud, the Gemara says, there's a Gemara in Sukkah and in Nun Aleph Amud Beis 51, this is B, that he who has not seen the temple of Herod has not seen a beautiful edifice in his life. The Gemara in Baba Basra and Gimel Amud Beis in 3b that claims that he did it, there was a it came of a pure religious motivation. After he had basically destroyed most of the scholars, he had pangs of conscience, and he, at the prodding of one scholar who he had blinded, Bava Ben Buta, he built the temple. The historian Rav Isaac Halevi wants to impute other motives as well. And his spin on the events was that Herod was very suspect by the Romans. Er gat große Augen. He had a great vision. In fact, he was the one, he not only gave and supported peoples and edifices in Palestine, but he really supported the whole Olympian Games that were in the that were falling into disuse. You know, you probably see his picture, like the official tyrant of the Olympian Games. You know, and they were afraid of his power, that he really wanted to go way beyond Palestine. As he gave to the Syrian, he gave to the people all over. And therefore, to allay the Roman fears, because basically he was working towards the Goyim, he wasn't working towards the Jews, and probably there was, the Jews were complaining all along, that he rebuilt the temple to show, I'm an equal opportunity tyrant, you know. Look, says, I help the Jews too. So he wants to offer other motives, that the reason he put all this effort in rebuilding the temple is to really allay the fear of the Romans, so to keep him, you know, an even keel on the government. At least that's Rav Isaac Halevi's theory. So even though it may be true that there were some positive motivations, but he was the last of the great Tzaddikim, Herod, maybe there were other motivations as well.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.